Hello and welcome to this latest building podcast. I'm Jamie Harris, building's digital editor. Coming up in this episode.
Yeah, they've got to get that down. They've got to somehow get back to being, have some sort of confidence back in the business. At the moment, they're just sort of going from one crisis to another.
As Interserv outlined its latest rescue plan to try to halt its alarming slide in market value from 500 million to just 17 million in 2 years, we discuss the debt for equity swap and the impact of a possible shareholder revolt. Also in this episode...
London tends to have a glacial attitude when it comes to doing these kind of big developments, and it's just been kind of in abeyance for years.
London is set to gain a new big budget symphony hall on the current site of the Museum of London on London Wall. But so often in the past, major cultural projects are beset with delays and going over budget. So what are the prospects for this planned £288 million Centre for Music? And finally...
Actually, you've got some very well-paid jobs out there in construction. We've now got QSs. That sort of seniority gets you six-figure salaries now. So they've bust through that barrier and they're now earning 100k.
This week sees the latest consultant salary survey results revealed, with a 2.6% rise across all job roles. But with Brexit looming ever larger over the horizon and employers looking for new tech-savvy skill sets in the talent pool, what can we make of these numbers? Stick around. Two years ago, Interserv was valued at £500 million and was one of the leading contractors in the sector. But 2 years on and 12 months after Carillion's collapse sent shockwaves across the UK construction, it's now become apparent that the troubled firm is scrambling to save itself. Since March 2018, when it agreed a £300 million rescue deal with lenders, Interserv has announced a £244 million pre-tax loss for 2017, with net debt topping £650 million. It has also counted the cost of its problem energy from waste jobs at more than £220 million. Its share price dropped to 6 pence in December. Joining Buildings editor Chloe McCulloch is Buildings news editor Dave Rogers to explain what's going on at Interserv in a nutshell and why this latest rescue plan is so significant.
Okay, so Dave, you've been following Interserv for quite some time, but there's been a latest development. Can you tell us about that?
There's a number of latest developments, but I suppose in the last week they would be the restructuring to get its finances on some sort of even keel, which has to be voted through by shareholders, although not all shareholders are in agreement. There's a US hedge fund that says doesn't agree with any of it and wants to get rid of the board, apart from the chief exec, Debbie White, and is calling for an emergency general meeting, which is likely to be held by the end of next month, that's March. Yeah, it's saying that under the terms proposed, effectively their shareholding is going to be wiped out, which is what is going to happen. And they're saying there's another way they could do this that would basically retain some form of shareholder value.
So the problem Interserv's got is its huge debt pile, isn't it? So this is what this rescue plan is designed to solve.
It is. And it's ongoing problems with energy from waste as well. It's also got some other issues in the Middle East, but energy from waste is the big issue that's really done it. Yeah, they've got to get that down. They've got to somehow get back to being, have some sort of confidence back in the business. At the moment, they're just sort of going from one crisis to another, not just in terms of another energy from waste scheme is late or we've missed this deadline, but they're also losing quite a few senior staff as well this week. Yesterday they had a guy, the main board director, a chap called Dougie Sutherland, who's been there 12 years. He's going end of the month. They've just got to hunker down and try and get through this period and somehow get back on an even keel. It has happened. There is a precedent before. Other firms have done that, Costain back in the 90s.
So, the big fear is that it goes the way of Carillion.
Yeah, the backdrop to all of this is Carillion, that they end up becoming another Carillion. And there's that's you know, they're a big government contractor. I think 70% of their 3-point-something billion turnover is with government contracts. And the big fear is that they go pop. Government has another Carillion on its hands, which is the last thing it needs. And then there's a mad scramble to plug those holes in government contracts. The other thing as well, of course, is the construction industry doesn't need another Carillion either. I mean, Interserv does build things still. And then obviously got into FM a la Carillion. That was the way to go some years ago. And then got into energy from waste about 6-7 years ago. But yeah, that's been a bit of a disaster.
So government is very keen for this rescue plan to work. It really, the sticking point is the shareholders who see their share value just reduced to,
well,
2%.
Pretty much, yeah, it's 2.5% of nothing really. I think their view is that there's another way you could do this, sort of like almost not manage decline, but you could get the debt down another way, and maybe with some disposals. The jewel in the crown is their shoring business, which is called RMD, and that was potentially put up for sale about 3 years ago by the former chief exec, Adrian Ringrose, and then was taken off the blocks a few months afterwards after a strategic review. The thing then is, if they'd have flogged RMD then, they'd have got a decent price for it, I think. It does make money and it's a profitable business. But if they're trying to flog RMD now, then they're a distressed seller, and the figure that it would have got 3 years ago is not going to be the figure that they'll get today. People will look at trying to take that on the cheap. So,
and under this rescue plan, RMD's got a crucial role to play in that's got to work really hard to pay off.
Yeah,
that's debt.
RMD is the bit of the business that the banks want to stay within, or the government wants to stay within Interserv, because that's seen as, without RMD, there's nothing really much left about Interserv.
So the timeframe, you briefly referred to it, but we know that obviously the company and the government wants this to go through. Shareholders aren't so keen.
Mm.
They've convened an extraordinary general meeting. It has to take place.
I think it's the announcement was last Wednesday. So Interserv then has 20 days to acknowledge that, and then they've already acknowledged it, but they then have another 20 days beyond that to actually fix a date, and it's probably going to be mid to back end of March, at which, because Coltrane owns more than 5%, they can call this. So they will have this probably back end of March, and they're trying to rally other shareholders to say, look, we're all in the same boat here. Do you think this works? We're all going to see our values completely decimated.
And are they
Why are we doing this?
Yeah. So are they confident they can make the argument?
I'm sure they're confident. Whether they will actually sway other investors over is a moot point, because of the fact that, realistically, Interserv saying this seems to be the only deal in town, and look at it on the face of it, it probably is. I don't really see how they can get the debt down that quickly any other way than what they've proposed last week. So I think shareholders will not be over the moon at this, but I don't really see what other choice they've got.
Yeah, and I mean, let's be clear, obviously Interserv is you know, on the critical list, and they're struggling to keep it going, and hopefully this will work. But there are other contractors in that space who aren't having a great time either.
No.
Put it into context.
No, I mean, in terms of, I mean, Kier's obviously had to have a rights issue. They've had issues.
That rights issue didn't go down great.
No. And they've racked up a load of debt. That's partly through acquisitions. Galliford Try has had to put out a rights issue because they've just lost an absolute lump of money on this road scheme up in Aberdeen, which is just hemorrhaging money.
And that's still not finished, is it?
That's
still not finished. It's the nightmare that keeps going on.
Yeah, yeah. They were supposed to hand that over end of last year. It's already over a year late, but there's negotiating tactics going on there as well between the two firms building that, that's Galliford Try and Balfour Beatty, and the client Transport Scotland. And of course the other one as well is Langer O'Rourke. They still haven't filed their 2018 accounts, and they were supposed to file them by the end of September. We're now in the middle of February, so they're 4.5 months late and counting, and they were late last year as well. And why is that important? Because they are the country's biggest private contractor, and probably after Balfour Beatty, the biggest contractor in terms of construction turnover. I know Kier and Interserv have bigger turnovers, but Langer O'Rourke has probably got a bigger contracting turnover than those two. So that's a major deal that their results are 4.5 months late.
So, I mean, we're coming into reporting season, obviously, so we'll probably have a better idea kind of end of March as to how all of the contractors are officially faring.
Yeah. I mean, Balfour's has actually turned things around. They've done pretty well. They were in a bit of a mess about 4 years ago, but they've turned things around. So it can be done. They had to bring in an outsider, Leo Quinn, to sort it out, which I suspect is what Kier will do. They'll bring in someone from outside the industry. The big thing for Interserv is they just need to get rid of these energy from waste schemes, because they're absolutely crippling them.
It's a bit of a lesson, isn't it, for contractors tempted into sectors where they may not have previously had experience.
It is. I mean, the problem with Interserv was, it never had done anything like this before. It was a building and civil engineering contractor, but they got into this energy from waste business about 7 years ago, 2012, and it's quite technical. You need a lot of know-how and knowledge, and Interserv has admitted they didn't have enough of it, and they've come a right cropper. I mean, bear in mind, 3 years ago, they were talking about taking a 70 million hit on one scheme in particular, this one up in Glasgow, but now they're talking about 220 million and counting. So
you look at their share price, and
it's
even
collapsed.
Just 2 years after the entry into energy from waste, they were still way up at like over 700 pence per share, and now what's it worth?
Well, it's dropped down to 11, and it's not quite, well, it is effectively a penny stock, as in it's bobbing around 10, 11, 12 pence. And will continue to do so for some time. I mean, at one stage, I think in December, it went down to 6.5p. You know, this is a company that has a turnover of 2 billion, and their market capitalization is something like 17 million.
It's a bit of a shocker.
It is. Yeah. It is. They've really hit the skids. But it can be recoverable. It can be recoverable. But energy from waste, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but they should have just completely steered clear of that.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Dave. I think we'll be watching closely for that shareholder extraordinary general meeting towards the end of March.
You can read our analysis on Interserv's plight in full online at building.co.uk/Interserv, where you can also keep up to date with the breaking news on the troubled contractor. Still to come on this podcast, we'll be poring over the latest trends in consultant salaries. But first, last month, US practice Dillard, Scofidio and Renfro unveiled its concepts for a £288 million Centre for Music, a new world-class symphony hall to be built on the site of the London Museum in the capital. But with historical examples of large cultural projects littered with controversy, from London's Royal Festival Hall to the Sydney Opera House, can we expect more controversy to come? Joining Buildings brand production manager Deborah Duke to discuss this issue is Ike EJ, Buildings architectural correspondent.
This week's magazine features a very exciting project that's coming to London, and that is the £288 million budget Centre for Music. So, Ike, could you just tell us a bit about the project, where it's planned for, and who's designed it, and whose idea it was in the first place?
Now, this new project, it's been called the Centre for Music. and it's going to be located in the City of London at the bottom end of Aldersgate Street. Essentially, it's where the Museum of London is located now, just on the southern edge of the Barbican. And the plan is to build a brand new world-class concert hall or symphony hall at that location. It's being designed by American architects, Diller, Scofidio and Renfro. It's their first UK project. They gained notoriety 2 years ago in the US for designing the Broad Contemporary Art Gallery in Los Angeles. They've done lots of high-profile projects in the States. A project of theirs is opening later this year called The Shed, which should give an insight into what the Centre for London will be like, because that's also a kind of large-scale concert venue.
Ike, we in fact both used to live in the Barbican Centre, and we're very familiar with that particular site. And it's a bit of an odd one if you were to pick an ideal place to put a new landmark project. The Museum of London as it stands is a sort of rotunda that forms a kind of roundabout. Could you just talk a little bit about how that particular site constrains the project and how it's responding to that in terms of what we've heard about so far? And also, maybe address the question some people are asking, which is that in fact the right place to put a new concert hall?
Well, those are crucial issues. A site is going to be a big constraint. Some may say opportunity, but either way, it's going to be a big issue in determining how successful this project is. Now, the reason it's going there is that at the moment you have the Museum of London located on the site, which is essentially a rotunda, elevated rotunda on a roundabout. So it doesn't sound the most glamorous site, but the Symphony Hall is going to be there because there are plans to relocate the Museum of London to new accommodation in Smithfield Market, which is just to the north of the site. I think it's been designed by Stanton Williams Architects. So that Museum of London's going to move, and that will release this site here for future development. And that is why the Opera House is being located there. Now, instantly, you can see one of the issues with the project. Nobody decided that this would be the best site for an opera house. Now, as well as the Museum of London issue, there are also kind of physical constraints concerned with the actual site. Anyone who knows a Barbican will know that it has a very good world-class cultural centre in the centre of it, but it's not famous for having an accessible public realm. Much of the Barbican, particularly at this end of the site as well, is based on elevated walkways and highways which are sparsely populated. So this whole area isn't known for having a really inclusive, accessible public realm. And as well as that as well, you obviously have the considerable constraint of it being built on a roundabout. Now, nobody would probably assemble these conditions if you wanted to have ideal circumstances for a concert hall to be built. So they're going to be big, big obstacles in making this site work.
The question is, do we need this? Do we want it? Is it worth £288 million when it's so near already to the Barbican's existing facilities for music? It's been said that we don't have a world-class opera house, but is this something that the public will welcome?
Well, it's been a controversial debate. London tends to have a glacial attitude when it comes to doing these kind of big developments, and this has been kind of in abeyance for years. It's been called for by Sir Simon Rattle, who at the moment, I believe, is the conductor of the Berlin Symphony Orchestra, before he comes to the London Symphony Orchestra to take over, assume the role there. So he's been a big flag bearer for this for several years. It's interesting. People assume London is awash with concert halls. We do have the Royal Festival Hall, there's a Royal Albert Hall, obviously there's a Royal Opera House, which is actually, even though it may not have the kind of huge architectural crunch of, say, the Sydney Opera House or the Garnier Opera House in Paris, the Royal Opera House is deemed as one of the best six opera houses in the world. But in terms of concert halls, the Royal Festival Hall has been extensively remodeled in recent years, but that too has limitations on its acoustics, and the Royal Albert Hall is famously poor for acoustics. The Barbican Centre performs better, so even though it does seem, obviously London is a cultural centre, it is awash with lots and lots of cultural venues, world-class cultural venues already. If we're looking at this specific coterie of world-class concert halls, there is a lack, and on that basis, even though it's going to cost a lot of money, there is a justification in my belief for a concert hall project being built. As to whether this is the right site for it, I think the jury's still out on that personally.
So, Ike, you've said that London doesn't yet have a big landmark, acoustically excellent concert hall or opera venue. So could this be our Sydney Opera House? Could this be our Hamburg Elbphilharmonie? In both in terms of significance and how much it's visited and taken to represent the city as a whole, internationally and in cultural terms, but also, could it be a project like that in terms of massive cost overruns? This sort of project, large music venues, is somewhat renowned for huge cost overruns, going over budget and over time.
First thing to say, to split hairs and be pedantic, which I always like to do, London does have a world-class opera house. The Royal Opera House is exemplary. And that's not, this isn't trying to mimic the Royal Opera House. This is trying to deal with the negation of a concert hall. Does this have the potential to become a kind of symbol or icon for London? Yes, it does. Obviously, these buildings attract a huge amount of public money. They attract a huge amount of national interest as well. And the City of London, it's a commercial, it's a corporate area. It has that kind of very strong monoculture to do with finance and making money. So cultural institutions within the City of London have a special prominence. So there's no reason why this couldn't become a kind of symbol for London. I'm always a bit reluctant when projects start out and saying they want to be an icon. Invariably, that doesn't happen. If you look at the Sydney Opera House, the design of the architect didn't say, I want to create a new icon. He wanted to create a striking building. He wanted to create an opera house that worked. But the Sydney Opera House became an icon much, much later, after its completion, when people realised there was something sculpturally pure and beautiful about its architecture, which could also be used to kind of represent the kind of young and dynamic country that Australia was. So being an icon is much more about what a building represents rather than what it looks like. Now, the other end of Deborah's question was to do with finance and money. And yes, there's no doubt about it. These projects do tend to go wildly over budget. The Sydney Opera House is famous for being a decade late. I think it was 1,000% over budget. The most recent example in Hamburg, the Elbphilharmonie, again, impressive piece of architecture, but that too was significantly late. I think that went 10 times over budget. The Philharmonie de Paris by Jean Nouvel, some years ago now, I think 3 or 4 years ago that opened, that was around, it went double, twice over budget. So there's a long and rather alarming pedigree of these buildings going wildly over budget and not sticking to their budget. Will that happen in London? Time will tell. One clever thing London has done is to suggest there should be 4 floors of commercial uses in the concert hall, which will help fund the project and help it pay for itself. Now, that's a double-edged sword. On one level, it does look financially expedient to kind of make the kind of concert hall partially pay for itself, make it be less of a kind of drain on the public purse. But on the other hand, it's an arts venue, it's a concert hall. Do we want to be kind of sullying that with kind of commercial activities and kind of, which could potentially detract away from its core purpose as being the stellar concert venue?
Ike, you're our architecture critic. Do you like it?
The first thing to say is with a meaty caveat, these are conceptual proposals. It's very, very early stages. It would be unfair to give the proposals released the same level of scrutiny we'd give to finished plans. There are elements I do like. There's a call for a room at the top of the concert hall, I think it's called the Coda, where you have these incredible views out over St. Paul's Cathedral. So that really grounds it and anchors it to its location. But speaking personally, there's elements about it already, I suppose, that give me some cause for concern. There seems to be a huge amount of glazing. I understand why that's there conceptually. It's to create transparency. It's to break down the kind of aloofness of a cultural institution to make it more accessible from street level. But there's a kind of, to me at least so far, there's an indistinct quality about the building. All that glazing, all the exposed structure gives it a kind of groundlessness, and maybe more work needs to be done to give it some kind of definitive form, to give it some shape, to give it muscles, if you like, so it can kind of take its kind of position within the skyline, but also within the pantheon of kind of great concert halls you have across the world. So let's see how the finished scheme looks and whether it can address what I'm far more interested in, which is the key issues of public realm and street level accessibility and countering the huge problems at site is going to give the project as well.
Thank you, Ike.
You can read Ike's analysis on the London Centre for Music online at building.co.uk, where you can also read thoughts from architects, acousticians and theatre consultants on this technically tricky project. And finally, this week sees the latest consultant salary survey results revealed, with a 2.6% rise in the annual average rise in wages. But with Brexit looming ever larger over the horizon and employers looking for new tech-savvy skill sets in the talent pool, what can we make of these numbers? Joining me is Building's editor, Chloe McCulloch. So, Chloe, what's the headline from this year's survey? 2.6% is fairly modest, right?
I think yes, 2.6%, it is above inflation, so that is good for you know, those consultants out there looking at their pay packets. That's what they could be concerned about. In a context over the past 5 years, it is actually the slowest annual rise that we've seen. So at the height, I think we saw in 2015 a 5.5% average pay rise across all job titles. So yeah, 2.6% is modest. It's luckily above inflation for people, but I think what that doesn't reveal on its own, and I guess what our headlines were this week on the back of the survey, is that actually you've got some very well-paid jobs out there in construction. So the real finding, I think, is that we've now got QSs, senior QSs, so partners or directors, albeit, you know, they're very senior, running the show. But in London, in the capital, that sort of seniority gets you six-figure salaries now. So they've bust through that barrier and they're now earning 100k. And that's wow. That's quite significant.
Yeah, that is significant. And I mean, given all the doom and gloom of Brexit and the skills crisis that we keep talking about, it's quite relieving, isn't it, that particularly to try and entice people to join the industry, that it's
lucrative. Yeah, I think it's a very positive story for the industry. Obviously, you know, you can't deny that the economic backdrop is a concern. You know, just recently the ONS stats were out showing that construction output has been a major drag on the economy over the last 12 months, and particularly in that last quarter, construction output actually fell by 0.3%. So that is a cause for concern, and it's, you know, it is a cause for construction professionals to think, okay, well, you know, where's the work going to come from in the coming 12 months? But having said that, I think consultants, or, you know, the consultants we spoke to when we were doing our research for this survey write-up, was, you know, actually QSs in particular are pretty buoyant about workload, and they're quite optimistic about their prospects. So, you know, the salary survey suggests that I think 70% of employers expect to award pay rises this year. So, and there's no, people are saying anecdotally that there's no kind of putting a brake on recruitment. So employees on their side are pretty confident that if they want to look around for another job, they could get one. So I don't think anyone, there's no real mood of pessimism. If people were really concerned, they tend to sit tight and not look around for new jobs. That definitely, according to this survey, they're not saying that. And I think that, you know, the 100k salaries that partner QSs in London are earning, you know, that's an average. So that disguises the fact that, you know, actually they could be in discussions over salaries going up to anything up to 130k, bonuses included, obviously. But that's, you know, that's a healthy salary.
Seems pretty buoyant, doesn't it, the industry?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that there's a bit of a gap between, you know, sort of new orders, a slippage in new orders, and that not coming through. But I still think consultants do have their sort of finger on the pulse, and if they're saying they're optimistic, then, you know, I think do you need to listen to them. They do seem to be quite happy with their lot. I mean, who wouldn't be on 100k? But
yeah,
but you know, that's a, for them, that's a 8% pay rise at that seniority. But across the board, you know, if you're looking at other job titles, you know, you've got good pay rises for, say, technologists, architectural technologists. they've got like a 3.8% pay rise. That's not bad. So those technical skills are very much at premium, and employers are willing to pay for them.
Of course, that comes back into the fact that the industry across the board is looking at, you know, things like digital construction technology, the use of these new technologies coming in and these new innovations, and with that, new skill sets are required. So perhaps they're looking around for people who are a bit more tech savvy.
Yeah, I think there are job titles that we don't actually see in this survey. You know, it'd be interesting to see surveys in the years to come that, you know, the list of job titles may well be changing, because employers are telling us that they're looking for, you know, people like software engineers who traditionally, you know, would have found work in the IT and sort of web company sector or fintech. Now construction companies realise they need those skills, and if they want them, they're going to have to compete for them in terms of salary. So it could be in salary surveys to come that those kinds of really hardcore tech skills are the ones that you know, bring with them the big bucks.
Okay, so what about the employees themselves? I mean, apart from, you know, a healthy pay rise, what are they looking for at the moment in their jobs?
Well, that's an interesting point, because obviously, you know, money matters, and we all also are very intrigued to know what other people are earning, which is the beauty of this survey. You get to kind of look across, look at job titles that are similar to yours, similar region, and think, okay, am I sort of in that ballpark? So yes, money definitely matters, and this survey is great for that. But what it also flags up is that employees are concerned about things other than money. So, you know, things that like their top, their list of sort of top kind of benefits is holiday. So they'd like more than just the minimum 28 days. Anything over that, that's seen as a top benefit. Pension provision above the legal minimum, that goes down really well as well. Health insurance or private medical cover, a company car or allowance, and then fifth, we come in with the training and support. So those are kind of the top five in that order that the survey came up with. And what's really interesting is that that doesn't match with what employers say they think are the top benefits. So employers top in ranking order is they think childcare voucher schemes are important, cycle to work schemes, then training and professional certification support, then pension provision, and then finally financial support for professional studies. So it's a completely different list. And I think that's, you know, if there are employers reading this survey, it might be wise to just reflect on how you are selling your company to employees plus current staff, and is your package matching up with what people want?
Okay, so more benefits, but not at the expense too much of the pay rise.
Well, yeah, pay rise is always welcome, I'm sure.
Okay, Chloe McCulloch, thank you very much. You can see the full survey results and analysis online at building.co.uk. Well, we're out of time on today's podcast. A reminder that you can keep up to date on future Building podcasts by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also catch up on our previous episode on Brexit, where Building spoke with industry experts on the potential impact of a no-deal Brexit on construction. Another note that readers and current subscribers have until the 28th of February to renew their subscription and beat the price rise. Find out more by going to building.co.uk/subscribe. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jamie Harris, Building's digital editor. We'll see you next time.